Wouldn't it be great if more of your fellow parishioners listened to Issues Etc.? Well, here's an easy way for you to publicize Issues Etc. at your church. Go to the support page of our website, issuesetc.org, and you'll find a short paragraph to include in your weekly church bulletin. Copy and paste the text for your church secretary or pastor to include each week in the Sunday bulletin. The bulletin blurb is updated weekly, issuesetc.org. Stay connected, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live Wednesday, January the 26th. Ready to start part three of our five-part daily series on the Crusades. Today, a crusade that you may be more familiar with than you realize. The stories of Ivanhoe, the stories of Robin Hood, are set historically, although they are fiction, they are set historically within the time of the Third Crusade. But what has changed since the previous Crusades? Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. He's Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
How has Islam and its scope, its power base changed from the previous Crusades by the time we get to the time of the Third?
Well, the most important change is political and military in the Middle East. A fellow who Westerners usually know as Saladin or Salah Saladin, I'm not going to say his whole Islamic name, I'm not really good at pronunciation anyway, but Saladin or Saladin is usually known in the West, by the 1180s had united essentially the areas we know today as Egypt and Syria under his rule. Egypt had actually been a Shia or Shiite-dominated state at odds with the Sunni Turks. So they had actually been at odds with one another, and that had benefited the Crusaders originally in the First Crusade. And so the other side was kind of divided. But by this time, by the 1180s, Saladin has united Egypt. He was actually a Kurd, interestingly enough, or ethnically a Kurd, but he was a Sunni, and he was united with the Turks. Other Turkish groups in the Middle East, and united to the caliph back in Baghdad. And so he was able to unite Syria and Egypt under his lordship, essentially, and make alliances with other Turkish groups as far north as what today would be Turkey. So he kind of had basically the Crusader states surrounded politically and militarily by the time of the 1180s.
He manages, or is it he? Is it Saladin that manages to take Jerusalem before the beginning of the 13th century?
That is the reason for the Third Crusade in 1187. For a number of reasons, mostly being that Saladin had intended to take Jerusalem. Saladin was an incredibly devout Muslim. That's the way he's pictured in the sources. Some of this is probably, talking him up a little bit, but that's fair enough. He's pictured as a man who followed the five pillars of Islam, who fasted in Ramadan, who prayed, I don't think he ever went on the pilgrimage to Mecca, but it's something he desired. He read the Quran regularly. He was also a man, the chronicles declare him as one who had the holy war or jihad in his heart and thought about nothing else all the time. He even said, I would like to conquer the Franks here and then get on a ship and go to where they came from and beat them there too. So he was not a meek and mild man. He was a man of his time, just like people on the other side. He wanted to reconquer Jerusalem, which he was able to reconquer Jerusalem. He talks about after he gets Jerusalem in October of 1187, after he's defeated the main Christian army at the Battle of Hattin a couple of months before that. He sends a letter and says, Jerusalem has been purified. God is no longer three, but he is one, which is an obvious reference to the Christian doctrine of the Trinity.
So this is, in its kind of quintessential form, this isn't just about the politics of the Islamic world meets the politics of the Western Christianized world. This is a clash of theologies as seen from both sides.
Yes, that's definitely the way they saw it. I mean, it doesn't mean, obviously, it is politics, it is military, but they didn't separate those two things or see them as different. To Saladin and to his followers and his army, this is God has rewarded them. Now, they have defeated the Christians in battle. There were a couple of Christian holdouts, the county of Tripoli, part of the county of Tripoli, City of Tyre, I think, was the other one, and there's one other one along the coast there that held out. And those were they were fortified from ships from the west. But that will be where the Third Crusade, most of them land at Acre, actually, in the north at Acre. And that's where Richard and Lionheart will land later, and Philip of France. And that's where they will begin to try to push back Saladin's gains and regain part of the territory.
Each time we've talked about one of these crusades, I've asked you about the papal call that essentially,
right,
officially begins these things, in the case of Urban and then Eugenius in the Second Crusade. It is Gregory VIII,
right,
who issues this call. Is it similar to his predecessor's calls for crusade?
It is similar. They kind of build on themselves, you know, they always kind of, often they'll mention, like, you'll say our predecessor or our, you know, said these things. His is actually larger, though. The letter is recorded in a couple of different chronicles we have. It's available in English translation, too. It's been translated a couple of different source places. And his is an expanded idea in many ways. One of the big things that happened was the Crusader army had a very famous relic that they had, I put in quotes, discovered when they came to Jerusalem in 1099, a relic that they believed to be a piece of the cross on which Christ died. It's usually known by shorthand as the true cross. There were these relics all over since the 4th or 5th century, but this is one that was especially important to them. And they kind of saw it as like their Ark of the Covenant, and they used to bring it out into battle. And it was in, for about a 50-60-year period, it was involved in about 30 different battles. At the Battle of Hattin, which they lost very badly, it was taken by Saladin and his army. And Saladin, they talk about it. They say, we've got the true cross, the idol of the Christians, and so forth. And this was... The loss of Jerusalem was huge, but all the sources of the Pope and the preachers and so forth all talk about the loss of the true cross as an example of God's punishment for Christian sin.
So is it sold the same way that the previous crusades?
Yeah, put it that way. It's preached. I think the preaching was a little bit more expansive, but there were certain... basically, from the papal court, the Pope appointed various archbishops in different places in Western Europe to preach the crusade. We have records of some of those preaching. We have a record, interestingly, in 1188 of a preaching tour through Wales, of all places, of a famous archbishop, one of the archbishops of Canterbury did. And that archbishop, his name was Baldwin, will actually end up going on the crusade and dying in Acre in 1190. So we have some records of these things. We have some records of some of the sermons they preached from different sources. So we do know a little bit about it. A lot of times it talks about the indulgence. It talks about repentance quite a bit. One of the focuses, even more than the previous ones, of the Third Crusade is not just the repentance of the crusaders themselves, but the fact that all of Christian society should be praying and repenting of its sins, because obviously if God has allowed Jerusalem to fall and the true cross to be taken, he's punishing us. And that the crusade will never be successful to retake these things unless society and individuals are transformed through conversion and penance.
Who led this? I mean, in its military sense,
right,
who went and led this crusade? The thing?
Yeah, and this is where a lot of people probably know at least one of the famous, the most famous knight, I'd say. Well, you know, it's debatable, but he's in the top two or three of medieval knights. His name was Richard the Lionheart. He became king of England. He took the cross before he was king. His father, Henry II, who was king of England, died in 1189 before the crusade was launched. And Richard the Lionheart led the English knights, a large English and somewhat Western French contingent, because not only was he king of England, he also had French possessions. He's probably the most well-known fellow because of those, because of the Robin Hood myth, I would say, or legend might be a better word. And the French king, Philip II, or Philip Augustus, as he's known, also led a large French army. And another Holy Roman Emperor, this time Frederick I, or as he's known also, Frederick Barbarossa, which means Frederick the Redbeard. Frederick is interesting. He had actually been on the Second Crusade as a very young man. So he was about 60 by this time, and he does die on the way. He does not make it to Jerusalem. He dies on the way. So this was, in many ways, one of the largest crusades, very large armies, three very powerful monarchs of Europe going. In many ways, a lot of these, especially Richard and Philip, were big rivals, so they really had to negotiate that. It probably took them over a year to negotiate that, just to go on the crusade, because they were both worried about each other stealing each other's land when they were gone. But so those were the big three that led the main crusade armies to, they ended up going to the Middle East to try to retake Jerusalem.
Militarily, was it successful?
It's a moderate success in this sense. They did, as I said, on the way, Frederick Barbarossa actually died trying to cross Asia Minor. Philip, he died, the story goes that he was in his armor and he fell off a horse and he drowned. I kind of think maybe he had a heart attack or something, but we don't know that for sure. But some of his army did end up going and fighting. So there were German knights that went, but he died on the way. Richard and Philip do get there. They do retake important coastal areas, and they reestablish essentially a beachhead. They protect Acre and Tyre specifically, and Tripoli, and keep those from falling to Saladin. And Richard stays the longest, and his desire is actually to stay and continue to fight, either fight to the death or take back Jerusalem. He comes to the conclusion that it would be impossible to take back Jerusalem. That they could attack Jerusalem and take it back, but the powers would come up from Egypt and take it back after they had cut them off from the sea, and then they would lose again. So he and Saladin actually make a 10-year truce after they fought for about a year or so. Well, off and on for maybe 2 years. And that it was a 10-year truce, not a peace treaty. And they Richard actually told him before he left, "I plan on coming back. I just want to let you know."
Well, let's take a break right there. Yeah. When we come back, we'll get the rest of the story on the military success of the Third Crusade. Part three of our 5-part daily series this week on the Crusades with Dr. Matt Phillips, Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska.
Trinity Orchard Farm is settled between two rivers, showing the way to the water of life. For worship that is reverent, relevant, and refreshing like pure water, or for excellent education in a unique setting, check out our church and school. We're just 5 miles north of Highway 370 on Highway 94 in St. Charles County. Visit us on the web at trinityorchardfarm.com. That's trinityorchardfarm.com. Our phone number is 636-250-3350.
Pop spirituality teaches you to look inside yourself. True spirituality teaches you to look outside yourself to the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is titled Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. You can purchase Lutheran Spirituality by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org, Lutheran Spirituality.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Gloria Christi Lutheran, Greeley, Colorado. St. John's Lutheran, Rosemount, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Waltham, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri. Zion Lutheran, Gravelton, Missouri. Christ the King Lutheran, Billings, Montana. Redeemer Lutheran, Nashville, Tennessee. And Zion Lutheran, Douglas, Wyoming. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Wednesday afternoon, January the 26th. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. Part three of our 5-part daily series on the Crusades. We're talking about the Third Crusade. When we went to the break, you were talking about the military success of the Third Crusade and a 10-year truce. Again, not a peace treaty, but a truce. Kind
That's
of
right.
What would we call it? Ceasefire, we would call it nowadays, between the Crusaders and Saladin. Pick up where you
right.
left off.
So basically, at that time, Richard decides he needs to go back home. One of the reasons for that is because, as I mentioned before, his rival back home was the King of France, Philip II. Philip had already returned, and he was making problems for Richard back home. So he decided he had to go back home, but he did plan on returning with another crusade. He was not able to do that because he did die in battle back in France, but later in his life, about 8 years later. So what it did do is it allowed Christians to visit. However, the truce did allow Christians to visit the Holy Sepulchre. Richard said he would not do that because he would not go to Jerusalem unless he took it. That was his attitude. But it did allow Christians to visit. It did allow Christians to make the pilgrimage. Ironically, Saladin dies about a year after Richard left, and most scholars say, you know, guessing if Richard had stayed around or if they had another crusade really quick after that because of the disarray on the Muslim side, they might have been able to take advantage of that and win back a lot more territory, but that's not what happened. So it is interesting the way the vagaries of history work sometimes. So that's basically how it ended, militarily speaking.
And how is, you mentioned this in passing just a moment ago, but the Ivanhoe/Robin Hood
right.
legends. Obviously, the Robin Hood legend, pretty old, all the way back to the 14th century, but it is set historically within the time of Richard's absence from
right.
Great Britain.
Yeah, the Robin Hood legend is usually that Robin of Locksley was a knight who went on the Third Crusade. There's various versions of it. The movies that have been around, the most recent movie is the one with Russell Crowe, which I thought was a pretty good movie. There were numerous historical problems with it. It did have Richard rightly killed by a crossbow in 1199 outside a castle in France. Outside of that, there were a lot of problems with it. It did have his brother John become King of England, but... it's said in that movie, usually it's portrayed as while the good King Richard was away crusading, the evil brother John was oppressing the people, and Robin Hood was the guy, you know, trying to rectify all those issues. So it's pretty much a myth or a legend. There has been some research done on that. Some people say it was a guy that was a robber from the 14th century or something. So that's basically how that goes.
Mike in Vancouver, Washington has this question. How does the modern Muslim culture use the Crusades to form their history lessons, and how off or biased are those lessons
right.
from the actual historical truth?
Well, generalizing, one of the odd things about the modern Muslim culture is they get a lot of their knowledge of the Crusades actually from Westerners from the late 19th and 20th centuries. And those Westerners like to compare the Crusades to their own colonization of the Middle East in the 19th and 20th centuries. So their perception of the Crusades is it was the, quote, first attempts of the Europeans to colonize the Middle East and take it over. And so that's almost an exactly backwards way of looking at it in some ways from the medieval perspective. In the medieval perspective, the Islamic civilization was the more advanced civilization in many ways, and they saw these Westerners as these Frankish barbarians who, you know, and in many ways that was true. In many ways, the Islamic civilization of the time was more, quote, advanced, and not in every way, but in many ways it was. So, and in reality, the Muslims win the Crusades in the end. I mean, by the 16th century, the Turks are in Europe, and they're attacking Vienna, and they're taking Hungary and Romania. It's completely flip-flopped. So the Turks used to think of what we call the Crusades as a great victory. It really isn't until the modern period of, like I said, these people that united pictured as the first colonialization, where it was talked about as this, where the Crusades were seen as a proto-colonialization and so forth. So a lot of the use of the Crusades, particularly by the more radical elements like Osama bin Laden and so forth, aren't really based in what happened in the Middle Ages.
So what you're saying is
the modern Muslim popularly gets their idea about what the Crusades were and what their goals were from Europeans who, in modern times, have either purposefully or unwittingly misunderstood the whole nature of the Crusades.
Well, that's what a lot of the more recent Crusade scholarship says, yes. It's particularly about works of Jonathan Riley Smith, a very well-known Crusade scholar, and my dissertation advisor there in St. Louis, Thomas Madden. So those are guys who have written a lot about that, and that's basically the main view. I'm sure there's nuanced views or disagreements over that in some ways, but that's basically the one I would come down with, yes.
At the end of the Third Crusade, are things better from the Western European perspective, or are they have we pretty much ended with a stalemate?
Well, it's a little bit better. Like I said, I would say it was a qualified success. They definitely shored up some of the coastal areas, but they certainly didn't gain back most of the Crusader states. They do have a beachhead if it were to continue fighting in the Middle East, and it does continue. Well, we can talk a little bit more about that. I guess we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow with Innocent III. The Fifth Crusade will be aimed at attacking Egypt, actually, but Egypt as a means to get to Jerusalem, because that was where the power was. So it did leave it as a bit of a stalemate, but I would say on balance, the Third Crusade, from where we started in 1186, for instance, and to where we end in the early 1190s after Richard leaves, the Muslims are doing better. I'll put it that way, from a military perspective.
Well, tomorrow, as you just said, we're going to be talking about Innocent III and the Crusades. Give us a brief preview.
Innocent III is really considered the peak of what I talked about yesterday, I think it was, the papal monarchy. He's a very powerful pope. He wields a tremendous amount of influence and power theologically, politically within Europe itself. And he was also a guy, the Pope, that kind of revolutionized the way Crusade was preached, the way Crusade was handled. He tried to manage it better to make it more effective, which is ironic because one of the first Crusade he calls ends up getting blown away off course. So we'll talk about that a little bit tomorrow. But he's really a transformative figure in medieval history in general, but specifically with crusades and crusade preaching and what you might even call the crusade culture in general. He's a very significant person for that reason, the early 13th century.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Good to be here. See you tomorrow.
And tomorrow we will be talking about Pope Innocent III and the Crusades, that turning point in Crusade history. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is called Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. Some of your favorite guests here on Issues Etc. have contributed to this Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. John Kleinig, John Pless, Pastor William Swirla, our good friend Bill Swirla, and someone we had on just yesterday, Dr. Naomi Chumasaki. What is written in this book is essentially a treatment of Lutheran theology from the grounds perspective, not from the ground up, but from the grounds perspective. What does Lutheran theology look like in terms of vocation, prayer, worship, the Christian life, fellowship, the church, dealing with all of those topics one by one through the lens of, with the gloves of, if you will, Lutheran theology. It's called Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and order Lutheran Spirituality. Their toll-free number, any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Ask for and order Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk about the late 4th century, early 5th century Bishop of Antioch and Constantinople, John Chrysostom. This is a big figure in early church history. We'll spend that time. Pastor Heath Curtis will be our guest. We'll also discuss President Obama's recent statement on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. Colleen Carroll Campbell will be our guest. And then we'll continue our series on the Crusades with Dr. Matt Phillips. We'll talk about Innocent III, this crucial pope, and the Crusades that he preached and promoted. We need to rightly understand our history. as it was, not as we want it to be. When we hear the Muslim complain about the imperialism of Christianity during the time of the Crusades, we need to know what it is we are talking about and what it is they are talking about. We need to know how to correct any misperceptions that there are, but we need to also be willing to admit to the fact that these things actually did happen and to understand why they happened, why those who did them did them. Even if we find the answers to those questions to be disagreeable, to disagree with our modern sensibilities, even to disagree with our enduring Christian sensibilities, we need to know our history and be able to understand it lest we repeat it. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.